Welcome back to The Deep Dive. I'm Lee Graham, and today we are really going deep. We've got our hands on what has to be one of the most information-packed sources you could imagine. We're talking about the entire edition of The Washington Post for Sunday, September 28th, 2025.
And you're not kidding. This is, well, it's massive. It's not just headlines. It feels more like a snapshot, maybe even a blueprint of some really high-stakes volatility, both here at home and around the globe. We're seeing these huge budget fights in Washington that feel, well, almost existential. And then there are these major shifts in foreign policy, plus some genuinely surprising things happening with consumer costs, stuff you really need to know.
That's exactly right. So our mission today is pretty clear. We need to cut through this mountain of information from the Sunday paper. We're going to zero in on the most critical pieces, you know, the looming political upheaval right here, the global crises that are maybe quietly reshaping whole continents. And like you said, those economic details that affect everyone's wallets. The idea is by the time we finish this deep dive, you'll have a really solid grasp of what was happening on this pretty pivotal Sunday in late September.
Okay, so let's jump right in with probably the biggest story, because it's unfolding right here in D.C. The federal government seems to be bracing itself for, well, a really radical kind of shakeup, and it's all tied to that looming funding deadline, October 1st.
Yeah, and, you know, we think we know what a government shutdown looks like, right? It's usually a disruption, an inconvenience. Essential workers, they stay on, but unpaid for a while. Non-essential folks get furloughed. But the key thing, historically anyway, was that everyone eventually got their back pay once Congress sorted things out.
Right. That was the standard playbook. But this time, the sources are painting a very different picture. It sounds like a radically different approach, maybe even aiming for something permanent. This seems to be guided by Russell Vought, the White House budget director, and that whole Project 2025 plan we've heard about. They're apparently looking at this potential shutdown not just as a pause, you know, a temporary thing, but more like a deliberate opportunity, a chance to force through some long-planned structural changes to the government itself.
It's like flipping the whole idea of a shutdown on its head. And the Vought Project 2025 vision, I mean, the language is stark. It's pretty, he's apparently told agencies to get ready for mass firings if the funding stops. And here's the kicker. They're told to keep only the minimal number of employees necessary, even after the shutdown technically ends and the money flows again.
Exactly. That's the permanent goal they seem to be driving at.
Right.
Radically reorienting the whole federal bureaucracy. It sounds like they want the government pared way, way down, focused almost entirely on just three things: defense, immigration, and law enforcement. Everything else, regulatory agencies, research arms, you name it. It seems like it's all on the chopping block for aggressive permanent cuts.
And you can already see the potential impact, the immediate tangible effects described in the paper.
Mm-hmm.
Like the Labor Department, it would basically shut down almost all its activities, maybe fire thousands of specialized staff permanently. National parks closing isn't new in a shutdown, but the idea that the furloughs could just become permanent layoffs, that's different. Even things people rely on, like IRS helplines, especially with tax season coming up, they could go unstaffed. And the sources suggest maybe they'd be gone for good.
Yeah.
It really feels like a deliberate, very aggressive strategy to shrink and reshape the whole administrative state.
And while that big structural fight is happening in Washington, you've got hundreds of thousands of federal workers caught right in the middle. Their paychecks are about to freeze. And you can imagine the panic is setting in. There's a personal finance column in the paper offering some pretty blunt advice, though it's tough, basically. Slow down your spending right now. Start hoarding cash because the uncertainty is just too high.
Yeah, it's like financial triage, isn't it? When the stress hits that hard, you focus on the absolute basics, first food, rent or mortgage, minimum payments on essentials. Everything else waits. And on the political side of things, you see Democrats trying to use this chaos, this moment, as leverage. They're reportedly pushing hard to get an extension of the Affordable Care Act subsidies and also trying to reverse those Medicaid cuts that went through earlier this summer.
Right. And that's important context for listeners. That $4.1 trillion, one big, beautiful bill from a few months back. It was huge, sprawling legislation, infrastructure, tax changes, but it needed big budget offsets to pass. And those offsets hit social programs like Medicaid. So Democrats now see linking healthcare relief to resolving the shutdown fight as maybe the best shot at clawing back some of those concessions they had to make earlier.
And this potential federal downsizing, it's not just a beltway story, is it? It has real geographic consequences. Maryland, for example, is singled out. The sources are projecting that these federal cuts could cost the state another 10,000 jobs, by the end of this year alone.
Yeah, Maryland's economy is just so deeply intertwined with the federal government. You've got huge defense contractors, agency headquarters, big research facilities. And the state's already feeling the pinch. It's lost about 15,000 federal jobs just since January. That was from earlier administration downsizing efforts. So if this new accelerated rate continues, the state's own projections sound pretty grim.
And the paper highlights a very specific, really high-value target. The potential closure of the Beltsville Agricultural Research Center. I mean, that's 800 skilled jobs, roughly $100 million in wages, right there in Prince George's County.
Yeah, it's huge.
It's not just numbers on a spreadsheet. It's like pulling an economic anchor out of a whole community. But here's something that seems, well, almost counterintuitive. Existing state revenue forecasts, they're only showing a marginal dip for Maryland so far. Something like $19 million below a $26 billion projection. Doesn't sound catastrophic yet.
Right, but that marginal loss could be really deceiving. State officials are apparently warning about this. They're saying that while the initial job losses haven't tanked income tax revenue right away, the deeper structural cuts proposed in that VOT plan, you know, eliminating entire agencies permanently, those will have a delayed reaction, a compounding effect. They expect the real economic pain, the recessionary effects, to hit much harder in the next fiscal year.
Okay, so we've moved from these budget battles, this potential upheaval, to something more direct, the use of force, which connects directly to the administration's increasing use of military and federal law enforcement powers domestically.
Precisely. The big news here is President Trump announcing the deployment of troops, specifically to what he called war-ravaged Portland, Oregon, and also to ICE facilities he described as being under siege. And he authorized the use of full force if necessary. I mean, this kind of militarization against domestic protests, it doesn't have much precedent in modern times.
And the legal justification he's using, that seems absolutely critical here. He's directing the counterterrorism apparatus, usually aimed at groups like Al-Qaeda, right, against Antifa and other domestic terrorists. Why is that specific label, domestic terrorists versus, say, protesters, so legally charged right now?
It's hugely important because political movements, even if their protests get chaotic or seem radical, are generally protected under the First Amendment freedom of speech, freedom of assembly. The source points out that Antifa is typically seen as this decentralized movement, not really a single unified organization that fits the legal definition of a terrorist group. So directing counterterrorism tools against them, it immediately raises these profound constitutional questions.
And you see the backdrop for this in Portland itself. The protests at the ICE facility there, they go back years, right? To 2018, started with the family separation policies. The White House is claiming local officials aren't dealing with crime, but the local leaders, Mayor Keith Wilson, Governor Kotek, they flat out rejected the federal deployment.
Yeah, they questioned the president's legal authority to even send troops in like that. But maybe more importantly, they pushed back hard against that war-ravaged description of the city. Residents were quoted saying the streets were actually pretty empty after the announcement. It suggests the whole portrayal of Portland needing this federal intervention might have been, well, exaggerated, maybe even manufactured to justify the military move.
And what makes this even more interesting is the contrast with what's happening down in New Mexico. Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham also deployed her state's National Guard to Albuquerque to help police under something called Operation Zia Shield. But she seemed to have gone to great lengths to make sure it didn't look like a military occupation.
Right. It sounds like a very careful balancing act, both politically and operationally. They sent 100 local soldiers, but here's the difference. They have no arrest powers. They're not wearing combat gear, no Humvees, no rifles. Their job is super specific. Secure crime scenes. That frees up the actual police officers to handle arrests, work on clearing case backlogs. The police chief there actually called it one of the best decisions I've made.
But even that much softer approach is getting pushback, isn't it? Community groups, the ACLU, they're arguing it still normalizes using the Guard for civilian policing. It blurs that line between military and police roles.
Yeah, that's the core criticism.
And there's a pastor mentioned, John Bolton, the community advocate, arguing it diverts money from what's really needed, social services. He's saying people struggling with addiction, homelessness, mental health issues, they need housing and resources, not just more law enforcement. He called the deployment a cheap answer to deeper societal problems.
And that really gets to the heart of a fundamental debate, doesn't it? Are you treating the symptom, crime, with more policing, maybe even militarized policing? Or are you trying to address the root causes with social spending and support? This deep dive shows both strategies are being attempted right now, just in different places with very different optics.
Speaking of power and control, that leads us to the last major theme in this domestic section, which seems to be about using the levers of federal power for, well, political retribution.
Yeah, the biggest headline here is definitely the indictment of James Comey. The charges are making false statements obstructing Congress related to that 2020 Russia interference inquiry. But what makes this really stand out, almost unprecedented, is the context surrounding it. The source details how the president got directly involved. Trump called Comey corrupt, a total slime ball publicly. And then, reportedly, he personally overruled career prosecutors who had initially decided not to file charges.
And that's where the legal angle gets really interesting and maybe tricky for the prosecution. Legal experts are saying that Trump's very public, direct push for this indictment could actually become the main defense strategy for Comey.
Right.
The defense can argue the whole case is improperly motivated. It's political payback, which could even be grounds for dismissal, potentially, because the president's comments might make it impossible for Comey to get a fair trial, a fair jury.
Mm-hmm.
It's this bizarre situation where the public push for accountability might actually undermine the case itself legally.
And in other legal developments tied to past political battles, we also saw Rudy Giuliani settle that big lawsuit with Dominion Voting Systems. Mm. This was over his repeated false claims about the 2020 election being stolen. The actual terms of the settlement, they're confidential. But this comes while Giuliani is facing just crippling financial problems from multiple legal battles.
Yeah, he seems to be drowning in legal fees. He was just ordered to pay over $1.3 million to some former lawyers. And that's on top of that massive $148 million judgment he settled earlier with those two Georgia election workers he defamed.
Right.
The source does note that the court let him keep some personal items, like his Yankee World Series rings, while he tries to navigate this financial mess.
And one last point on this legal front. The administration is pushing that birthright citizenship case all the way to the Supreme Court. They're appealing lower court injunctions from Washington State and New Hampshire that blocked the executive order, the order that tried to deny citizenship to many people born right here in the U.S.
Yeah, an effort most constitutional scholars call legally dubious. I mean, the 14th Amendment seems pretty clear on this.
It does.
But the administration is pressing on anyway. The one related area where the Supreme Court did side with them previously was on a narrower procedural issue.
Yeah.
About limiting the power of those nationwide injunctions from lower courts.
Yeah.
So maybe they think they can at least limit the scope of the opposition's legal wins, even if the core policy itself is ultimately struck down. Still, they're pushing it.
So if you step back and look at this whole domestic picture,
yeah,
what we're seeing is this pattern. Political crises, whether it's a budget fight, a protest, a legal case from the past, they're being transformed, used as tools, really, for what looks like permanent unilateral executive action and reshaping of government power.
That's a really sharp observation. And it actually provides a perfect bridge thematically, because that same focus on unilateral action, on aiming for permanent change, seems to be exactly what we're seeing play out on the global stage as well. So let's pivot now. Let's look at those international flashpoints and the foreign policy shifts underway.
Okay. And probably the most significant, most potentially transformative development is what's happening in the West Bank. It's largely happening in the shadow of the ongoing Gaza conflict, but the implications are huge. Actions being taken by Prime Minister Netanyahu's government alongside settlers seem very clearly designed to lay the groundwork for permanent Israeli control over that territory. Territory that, you know, most of the world sees as the core of any future Palestinian state, while many Israelis view it as their historic homeland.
And the speed of these actions is really something. The sources say Israel's approving new Jewish settlements at a record pace. Settlers are establishing more informal outposts than ever before. But the real game changer, the one that jumps out, is the advancement of the E1 plan. This project was held up for like 30 years, mainly because of intense international opposition.
Exactly. The E1 plan involves developing this chunk of land, about 3,000 acres, just east of Jerusalem. The goal is to physically connect Jerusalem to the big settlement of Ma'al Adumim. Doing that would essentially double Ma'al Adumim's population, which is already around 42,000. Now, historically, the reason everyone opposed this, including past U.S. administrations, both parties, was that building E1 would effectively slice the West Bank in half. It makes territorial contiguity for a Palestinian state, well, almost geographically impossible.
But now it seems like those international constraints, those guardrails, they're just gone. The U.S. ambassador, Mike Huckabee, is quoted saying, quite simply, "We will not tell Israel what to do."
Wow.
Which effectively sounds like a green light for a project that could define the physical landscape of this conflict for generations.
And beyond the settlements, there's also this physical, really fundamental transformation happening inside Palestinian refugee camps. For the first time since the Oslo Accords back in the 90s, the Israeli army has maintained these extended, deep deployments inside camps like Tulkarm, Nur Shams, and Jenin. We're talking about displacing something like 40,000 residents in the process.
And it's not just about policing, is it? The description is much more profound.
Yeah.
The military operations involve demolishing hundreds of buildings. Why? To pave these wide concrete avenues straight through the heart of the camps.
Right, specifically for military vehicles.
Palestinian officials are quoted pointing out that by leveling these old neighborhoods, places people live for generations, the IDF is essentially erasing the last physical reminders of the thousands who fled or were forced out during Israel's creation in 1948. It fundamentally changes the geography, the psychology, everything about the refugee issue right there on the ground.
And while all this consolidation of control is happening, there are still diplomatic efforts, at least on paper, regarding the Gaza conflict. U.S. officials apparently shared a draft 21-point peace plan at the U.N.
Yeah, the draft calls for destroying Hamas's offensive weapons, offering amnesty to militants who commit to peace, and giving safe passage for others to just leave Gaza. But, maybe predictably, neither Israel nor Hamas has actually agreed to it yet.
No.
And Prime Minister Netanyahu gave this really defiant speech at the UN. He basically said, Israel won't let Western governments shove a terror state down our throats.
Yeah.
Prompted dozens of delegations to just walk out and protest.
Right. And these actions in the Middle East, the defiant tone, the pragmatic, maybe unilateral moves, they all feed into this bigger debate that's happening about the Trump doctrine in foreign policy, if there even is one. Critics and supporters are really fiercely divided on whether there's any coherent philosophy behind it all.
The criticism is pretty sharp, especially from former insiders like John Bolton. He says, flat out, I don't think he has a philosophy. It's all about his interest and what he wants. Bolton argues there's no real intellectual framework, no Trumpism, that's going to outlast the administration itself.
But then you have supporters, like Victoria Coates has mentioned, who argue, no, the policy is philosophical. They define it as being strictly guided by U.S. national security and economic prosperity, period. Not by some abstract greater good. So the doctrine, from their view, is simply what serves American interests right here, right now, regardless of traditional alliances or, you know, moral postures.
And you can see that kind of pragmatic interest-first approach in recent actions, like the very warm meeting with Turkish President Erdogan, despite his government's human rights record. Why? Because Trump apparently sees Erdogan as a useful go-between for potentially brokering deals in both Ukraine and the Middle East.
Right, a transactional approach.
Exactly. And you see it in that suggestion he floated that the Ukraine war might end with a return to the original borders. I mean, that's a potentially massive shift that would completely rewrite the conflict and, frankly, European security assumptions.
And that takes us right into the heart of Europe, where there's significant geopolitical tension playing out, specifically around the parliamentary elections in Moldova. These elections might seem small scale, but they're attracting a lot of international attention. Moldova's fate is being seen as sort of a bellwether for Europe's future vulnerability to Russian influence.
Yeah, the Moldovan president, Maia Sandu, issued a really stark warning. She said Russia is pouring hundreds of millions of euros into Moldova, specifically to interfere in this election, mostly using disinformation, trying to stop the country from aligning more closely with the European Union. The stakes for the whole region feel incredibly high.
They really are, because you have to remember, Russia already has troops stationed in that breakaway Moldovan region, Transnistria. If a pro-Russian government wins the election in the capital, Chisinau, well, that potentially gives Moscow a vital new land route, a way to access Ukraine's key southern port, Odessa, possibly bypassing Ukrainian defenses along the current front lines.
And beyond the military angle, having an ally in Moldova could also be a huge boost for Moscow's intelligence operations across Europe.
That's a key point. A large number of Moldovans also hold Romanian citizenship,
which gives them the right to live and work freely anywhere within the EU.
Yeah.
The source notes that disinformation campaigns targeting Moldova have increased like tenfold compared to past elections. It just highlights how crucial this small country has become in the wider information war.
Okay, shifting gears, let's go across the globe now to Asia. There's major economic fallout happening because of that new, very steep fee the U.S. imposed on H-1B visa applications.
We're talking about a $100,000 fee per application. I mean, that's just astronomical. And it effectively slams the door shut for most applicants from India, who normally make up almost two-thirds of all H-1B recipients.
Huge impact.
It's a massive blow, not just to the UF tech industry that relies on that talent, but also potentially to the whole U.S.-India relationship. Now, some leaders in India are trying to put a positive spin on it, saying, oh, great, this will help us keep our skilled workers home, boost our own industries. Mm. But analysts quoted in the piece sound really skeptical about that.
Yeah, the skepticism comes from a pretty basic place. Does India actually have the ecosystem right now, the jobs, the infrastructure, the R&D environment, to absorb the sudden influx of highly skilled tech talent, effectively? Most analysts seem to think, not really. Not yet. So the more likely immediate outcome isn't that the talent just stays home. It's that global talent flows get redirected. And competing countries, Canada, Britain, even China, are apparently jumping on this, highlighting their own more welcoming visa policies to attract these skilled Indian workers who can no longer easily come to the U.S.
And it's also causing political ripples within India itself. Opposition leaders there are criticizing Prime Minister Modi. They're pointing to his very public friendship with President Trump and arguing, look, what has it actually gotten India? They're using phrases like bear hugs, hollow slogans, suggesting the relationship hasn't delivered tangible benefits for Indian citizens, especially now with this visa situation.
These kinds of global economic shifts, the visa changes, the potential trade disruptions, they lead us perfectly into our third major area for today, looking at the economic headwinds here in the U.S. and the direct impact on consumers.
Right. And the big item here is President Trump's new round of tariffs. These are sector-specific, and they're set to hit on October 1st. The rates vary, but they go from 25% all the way up to 100% on certain imports. We're talking pharmaceuticals, heavy trucks, kitchen cabinets, bathroom vanities, and upholstered furniture. Very specific targets.
And the immediate result, almost guaranteed, higher prices for consumers. These tariffs are threatening to pour fresh fuel onto the inflationary fire, an inflation that's already been stubbornly above the Fed's 2% target for 4.5 years now, and companies are scrambling. It's not easy to just switch suppliers overnight.
Yeah, there's a great example from the furniture company RH, Restoration Hardware. They noted they are trying to shift sourcing away from China because of the tariffs. But their CEO stated very clearly the kind of high-quality manufacturing they need. It just doesn't exist at scale in America right now to quickly replace those imports. And with pharmaceuticals, it's similar. Companies can get tariff exemptions, but only if they're actively breaking ground or already under construction on new U.S. manufacturing plants. Which means in the short term, consumers are facing unavoidable higher drug costs until those huge multi-year factory projects actually come online.
And this kind of inflation, driven by supply constraints like tariffs, it really complicates things for the Federal Reserve. The Fed's main tool is raising interest rates, right? Which is designed to cool down demand. But if the inflation is coming from tariffs restricting supply, raising rates might just cause unnecessary economic pain. It could soften the job market without actually fixing the tariff-driven price hikes. It's a classic tough policy dilemma for them.
What's really kind of mind-boggling, though, is the sheer amount of money these tariffs are expected to bring in.
Right.
The estimates are around $30 billion a month. That could be maybe $500 billion a year.
Wow, that's huge.
Yeah. And the financial section of the paper spends a lot of time debating, okay, what should we do with this enormous pile of tariff cash?
There seem to be three main options being discussed. First, you could use that money for targeted subsidies or tax breaks for domestic manufacturers. Basically, pay them to ramp up production here to replace the imports that just got more expensive. Second option, broad-based tax cuts for consumers. That would be a direct way to try and offset the higher prices people are paying because of the tariffs.
And the third option, maybe the one with the biggest long-term structural impact, is dedicating all that revenue to deficit reduction. The projected federal deficit for 2025 is around $1.7 trillion. Using that tariff money could cut the amount the government needs to borrow each year by almost a third.
That's substantial.
It really is. And theoretically, that could lead to lower interest rates, lower bond yields, free up private money for investment, and really strengthen the country's financial footing long term. Big debate there.
Okay, shifting from tariffs to healthcare costs, specifically the weight loss drug situation, this really captures that tension between something being cost effective in the long run versus being affordable right now for millions of people.
Yet, the Institute for Clinical and Economic Review, ICER, They're a nonprofit group. They just released findings on those GLP-1 drugs, you know, like Zepbound and Wegovy, tirzepatide and semaglutide. I sort of found they are highly cost-effective, but only when you measure the benefits over a person's entire lifetime.
Oh, so?
Because they help prevent really expensive health problems down the road. Things like developing type 2 diabetes, having heart attacks or strokes. So eventually they save the healthcare system money.
Right, but that's the paradox, isn't it? Even with those long-term savings factored in, the immediate cost of the prescriptions, which can still be, what, up to $6,000 a year, even with discounts, that upfront cost threatens to just completely swamp health insurance plans right now. And the reason is the sheer scale. The ICER analysis points this out. If this was a drug for some rare disease, covering it would be easy. But because something like 40% of the entire U.S. population is obese and could potentially benefit, the massive number of potential users makes it uniquely unaffordable under current insurance models. So coverage has basically stalled out. Only about half of employers are covering these drugs right now. Huge dilemma.
Meanwhile, while we're talking about inflation and struggles in traditional retail, there's this unexpected success story. A real market underdog. Build-A-Bear Workshop. Their stock has just gone on this incredible run, up over 2,000% since its low point in 2020. It went from like $1 a share to $73. It's actually outperformed huge tech stocks like Nvidia over that same period.
That is fascinating. And it really speaks to the power of experiential retail, doesn't it? Even in today's economy, Build-A-Bear is defying two big trends. It's a physical store, often in malls, and it's thriving. And it's doing this in the toy category, which gets hit hard by tariffs. So how are they doing it? The success seems to come down entirely to that unique, hands-on, in-store experience, you know, where kids and adults literally build their own stuffed animal.
And they're really leaning into that kidulting trend, too. Adults, people buying toys for themselves, maybe out of nostalgia or for collecting, apparently make up about 40% of their business now.
Wow, 40%.
Yeah, driven by licensed characters from movies and games. And they even have these website-only After Dark collections aimed at adults. It just shows, even when everyone's shopping online, there's still huge value in offering a unique, tangible, fun experience.
Okay, let's move into our fourth major theme now. This one covers culture, the flow of information, and some really concerning public health threats. And the intensity of the political rhetoric we talked about earlier, it seems to be having a really damaging impact on specific communities.
Yeah, this is deeply troubling. The news about the rhetoric around autism, following recent comments from President Trump and also the HHS Secretary Robert Kennedy Jr., families are really worried. They fear that decades of progress toward inclusion, towards acceptance, could just be completely undone.
The language being used is described as highly alarming. Both leaders apparently used words usually reserved for diseases, for contagion, calling autism a crisis, an epidemic. And Secretary Kennedy also repeated several claims that have been thoroughly debunked by science, trying to link autism to vaccines or to using acetaminophen during pregnancy and describing autistic people as these burdens who will never pay taxes, never hold a job. Just awful stuff.
And this isn't just, you know, political chatter. This is language that has real-world consequences. Mm-hmm. It forces families to suddenly worry about their child's safety in public. It unravels years, decades of work towards integration and understanding. Mm-hmm. Parents from the autism community are quoted saying they feel unsafe now. They're worried about a return to the days of institutionalization. Imagine hearing political leaders describe your child in ways that make them sound like they destroy families. The trauma is immense.
And the impact was immediate and measurable, according to the report. The CEO of a nonprofit that supports autistic individuals said requests for emergency counseling just surged right after that briefing. Parents were calling in, deeply distressed, genuinely asking if they had somehow caused their child's autism based entirely on these debunked claims from the administration. Just devastating.
And this kind of dangerous rhetoric, it flows right into the larger conversation about vaccine hesitancy. President Trump also publicly encouraged parents to break up the standard childhood vaccine schedule. He called the current CDC recommendation a disgrace.
Right. And medical experts are universally warning delaying vaccines is incredibly risky, especially for babies, for infants who are most vulnerable to severe complications, even death, from diseases like pertussis whooping cough. The scientific consensus is clear. Getting several vaccines at once is safe and effective. But public opinion is shifting. A recent poll found 1 out of 6 parents say they have delayed or skipped some routine shots for their kids. And 26%, more than a quarter, now believe the CDC recommends too many childhood vaccines. That's a worrying trend.
Okay, Let's pivot slightly now, look at the actual gatekeepers of information, and there's an interesting contrast highlighted between how traditional media operates versus online content creators.
Yeah, it's a fascinating duality. On one hand, you have traditional media like TV networks. They still have to answer to regulators like the FCC. We saw this with the suspension of Jimmy Kimmel after he made comments about a political killing. That suspension was reportedly triggered by threats from the FCC chairman himself. So, clear regulatory pressure there.
But online, it's a whole different world. The censorship mechanism isn't the government, usually. For internet comedians, people with huge online followings, they answer to the algorithm and to the ad deals that fund their content.
Right.
The sources suggest that content with a more right-leaning perspective often thrives in this environment, sometimes by playing into the platform's volatility. Conservative comics, like Chrissy Mayer has mentioned, can build big audiences by catering to specific niches, saying they can go as hard or as dark as you want online.
But even online, there's still pressure, just a different kind. Some comics admit they practice self-censorship. They use what's called algospeak, these linguistic workarounds, like saying unalive instead of die, or spelling out S-E-X, or using substitutes like segs.
Right, to avoid getting flagged.
Exactly, to avoid getting flagged by the platform's AI moderators and then having their videos buried or demonetized. So in a weird way, the algorithms themselves have become these invisible censors, shaping language and discourse even in the supposedly anything-goes world of online comedy.
Okay, rounding out this section, let's turn to the legacy of art and film. First, a celebration. The Rocky Horror Picture Show is marking its 50th anniversary. It's officially the longest-running theatrical release in film history.
Yeah, and its real legacy goes way beyond just the movie itself, doesn't it? It's about the whole subculture it created. Those interactive screenings with audiences shouting lines, throwing things, the shadow casts acting it out live. The article calls it an experimental laboratory of gender-bending cosplay. It became this space where misfits, people who felt like outsiders, could find community and express themselves. And apparently, that whole interactive tradition started with just one person shouting back at the screen in 1976, yelling, "Buy an umbrella, you cheap bitch," at a character. And it just grew from there. It's still this edgy, community-building phenomenon.
Now, on a much, much darker note regarding film history and legacy, there's a new documentary about Leni Riefenstahl, the Nazi filmmaker. And the piece underscores why she remains such a problem to be solved even all these decades later.
Riefenstahl is infamous, of course, for making propaganda films for Hitler, like Triumph of the Will. She managed to survive the fall of the Third Reich, largely avoided consequences, by constantly lying about her role. She always claimed she was just an artist, interested only in aesthetics, not an ideologue, not someone deeply complicit with the regime, just an artist. But this new documentary apparently unearths a really disturbing detail.
Yeah, it reveals that after she appeared on a talk show in 1976, where she apparently just doubled down, came across as energetic, unrepentant, she received this outpouring of support, specifically from Germans of her own generation.
Wow, that's chilling.
It really is. It suggests this deep-seated nostalgia, maybe even longing among some, for that Nazi-era sense of moral certainty and continued quiet support for far-right ideas. It's a reminder that just exposing an ideologue's lies often doesn't change the minds of those who want to believe them.
And just quickly, we should also mention that local DC canon segment, where local artists and creators picked works that they felt really defined the city's identity. Rapper Goldlink chose a Fugazi EP, calling it a perfect introduction to DC aggression and energy. Makes sense. And Bo Willimon, who created House of Cards, picked the Hal Ashby film Being There. He liked its portrayal of this innocent, almost alien presence right at the center of political power. Interesting choices.
Okay, let's transition now into our fifth section. This is where we get into some really compelling human stories, the emotional core of the paper.
And the biggest news here is that incredible breakthrough in the 1991 Austin, Texas yogurt shop murders. After decades of uncertainty and pain for the families, DNA evidence has finally linked a man named Robert Eugene Brashers to those horrific killings of four teenage girls. Brashers actually died back in 1999, reportedly by suicide at age 40.
That case has such a tragic and complicated history. There were false confessions early on, convictions that were later overturned in 2009 when DNA pointed to a different unknown male suspect. The four victims, Amy Ayers, Eliza Thomas, and the Harbison sisters, Jennifer and Sarah, were bound, shot, and then the shop was set on fire. Just brutal. And this breakthrough linking Brashers is huge, especially since the report notes he was also connected to the 1998 killings and sexual assault of a mother and daughter over in Missouri. It suggests he was potentially a serial predator who went undetected for years.
Such a heavy story. Yeah. Another deeply poignant piece focuses on North Carolina, looking back 1 year after Hurricane Helene. That storm killed at least 108 people and caused an estimated $60 billion in damage there. The article profiles Peggy Williams. Her partner, a musician named Lenny Wadowski, is still officially listed as unaccounted for since the hurricane hit.
Yeah, she's trapped in this awful kind of limbo, isn't she? The story describes her going back to the spot by the North Tow River where their home used to be. It's just quiet now. She keeps up this makeshift memorial there. She mows the grass, trims the weeds around the only thing left of their house, a stone fireplace.
Oh, wow.
And she talks to him there. It just captures the raw, ongoing grief that's still so present in that community, stretching into another fall.
We also need to pause and acknowledge the passing of a civil rights pioneer. Bobby Kane died at 85. He was one of the Clinton 12, the group of black students who integrated the all-white high school in Clinton, Tennessee, way back in 1956.
And his story, his involvement, was almost reluctant at first. The article notes he only joined the integration effort because his family couldn't afford the bus fare to send him to the segregated black high school in Knoxville.
Right.
He faced constant threats, verbal abuse, violence. But he persevered and became the very first black student to graduate from an integrated public high school in the entire South. But tragically, just 2 years after he graduated, that same high school was bombed, destroyed, and no one was ever arrested for it.
And finally, in this section, a local D.C. story. It's about community resilience, really. Fiesta D.C. It's the big annual Latino festival. And it went ahead this year, despite organizers admitting they had serious safety concerns. This followed a period of increased immigration enforcement actions in the D.C. region. Over 900 immigrants were reportedly detained during a 30-day crime emergency period just before the festival.
Yeah, so there was real fear in the community. But Maria Patricia Corrales, the festival's president, explained why they decided to go forward anyway. She said, quite simply, they had to do it to show our kids our strength.
Powerful.
It really is.
Yeah.
The crowds were apparently smaller than in past years, maybe not the usual 100,000 people, but it remained the largest Latino festival in the area, a powerful collective statement, refusing to let fear shut down community life and celebration.
Okay, that brings us to our final section. A bit of a change of pace. Sports, travel, and some quick hits. Much needed after some of those heavier stories.
Definitely. Starting in the WNBA, where an officiating crisis seems to have really boiled over, the Minnesota Lynx coach, Cheryl Reeve, got suspended for Game 4 of their series after just unleashing on the officials in a post-game press conference. This came right after her star player, Nafisa Collier, got injured in a play. Reeve felt involved, uncalled fouls, uncalled physicality.
And Reeve didn't hold back at all. She called the officiating malpractice, said it was bad for the game, and went so far as to call for a complete change in league leadership over the issue. Players have apparently been saying privately that officiating is getting worse. But the WNBA commissioner, Kathy Engelbert, her response was pretty defensive. She essentially dismissed the criticism, noting that no winning team ever complains about officiating, basically calling it sour grapes.
Okay, over in the NFL, a couple of quick notes. First, the Washington Commanders are apparently dominating in special teams, which is often kind of an overlooked part of the game. Under head coach Dan Quinn and special teams coordinator Larry Izzo, their success is being credited to intense player buy-in. Veterans treating it seriously, dedicating quality roster spots to specialists like Jalen Lane and Jeremy Reeves. Oh.
And the second NFL note is about Carly Ursay Gordon, the owner and CEO of the Indianapolis Colts. She's getting attention because she's one of the very few female owners who's actually on the sideline during games, wearing a headset, taking detailed notes.
Right, actively involved.
Yeah. She inherited the team from her father, Jim Ursay. And she really stands out in a league where women are often, you know, cheerleaders or sideline reporters. The piece highlights her as not a boss lady, just a boss, making her mark in a very male-dominated world.
Now, shifting to a more critical take on sports, there's a piece discussing the idea of sports washing. Usually that refers to authoritarian regimes using sports to improve their international image. But this article suggests expanding the concept to sin washing, where sports are used to kind of transfigure or cleanse the image of controversial individuals or movements.
Yeah, the specific example given was the memorial tributes held for the conservative commentator Charlie Kirk at some NFL games after his death. The argument is that these very positive, lionizing portrayals completely overwhelmed any mention of his more controversial or incendiary stances, things like accusations of racism or misogyny. So by hosting these tributes, the leagues were seen as effectively washing Kirk's reputation, despite his views perhaps clashing with the values sports often claim to promote, like inclusion and respect. Interesting angle.
Okay, switching gears to travel tips. Mm-hmm. First up, a surprisingly common nightmare. Confusing airports, especially here in the D.C. area. Mixing up Dulles, IAD, and Reagan National, DCA, happens all the time, often just because people are on autopilot while booking flights.
And it's not just local. The article mentions people accidentally booking flights to Tunisia instead of Nice, France, or even ending up in Sydney, Montana when they thought they were going to Sydney, Australia.
Oh my gosh, Sydney, Montana.
Can you imagine? Yeah. Travel experts basically say, double check your itinerary before you leave home and be really careful with those super cheap fares from search engines that sometimes require you to make your own connections between different airlines. Risky.
Good advice. Now, for train travelers on the Northeast Corridor, there's a detailed review of Amtrak's new Acela trains, the next-gen fleet. They get good marks for much better Wi-Fi, finally 5G enabled, and apparently the bathrooms are huge. Big improvements there.
But there are some quirks noted. The cafe car, it's standing room only now, designed just for grabbing food and leaving, not for lingering. And in first class, while the service and amenities like hot towels and USB-C ports are nice, the food quality was called inconsistent. One reviewer said their Korean short rib meal tasted, unfortunately, like it had been microwaved to oblivion. Not exactly premium.
Ouch. Okay, and lastly, some practical advice for eating street food safely when traveling. Experts say the key things are: make sure the food is cooked piping hot, right in front of you if possible. Look for busy stalls with high turnover. That means ingredients are fresh.
Good tip.
Avoid vendors who handle money and food without washing hands or changing gloves. Stick to high-heat cooking methods like grilling or deep frying. Generally safer.
And maybe be cautious with raw foods like ceviche unless you're really, really sure about the vendor's hygiene and sourcing. Better safe than sorry.
You know, Lee, trying to synthesize all of this, I mean, it's an incredible amount of information from just one Sunday paper. But what really stands out to me, threading through so many of these stories, is this pervasive atmosphere of, well, unilateral control, maybe, and volatility. Domestically, you have the government potentially using a shutdown, not just as a pause, but as a tool for radical permanent change to how things work. Globally, we see moves seemingly aimed at establishing permanent territorial control in the West Bank, or Russia trying to exert geopolitical control over Moldova's future. Yeah, and all of that is happening alongside this deep sense of anxiety felt by ordinary people. You know, federal workers facing potential career oblivion, the parents who are terrified that political rhetoric is erasing years of progress for their autistic children, the communities trying to stand strong against fear, like at Fiesta DC. It really underscores how much constant critical engagement is required now just for you, the listener, the modern citizen, to stay informed and navigate the world safely. It feels like the sheer volume of information hitting us is almost as much of a challenge as the actual content of the news itself.
And that leads perfectly to a crucial closing question, I think, based on all this volatility we've discussed. You know, veterans of past government shutdowns, they often argue that the political fallout who gets blamed usually has a pretty short half-life. The party, seen as responsible in the moment, isn't necessarily punished harshly in the next election cycle. People move on.
Right. But if this time is different, if this potential shutdown is being deliberately used, as the VOT Project 2025 plan seems to suggest, to trigger mass firings, to fundamentally and permanently reshape the federal government, does that traditional wisdom about short-term political costs still hold true? Or is this current chaos actually designed to create irreversible changes, regardless of what the temporary political price might be? Something for you to definitely think about and maybe dig into more after this deep dive.
Indeed. A lot to process. Thank you for joining us today.
We'll see you next time on The Deep Dive.